what is going on in the world? Ukraine and Russia have been locked in a battle that's lasted now 20 months, and now it just seems like it's a war of attrition. There's not really that much progress on either side of the lines. And if that weren't bad enough, 3 weeks ago, Hamas launches a surprise attack against Israel and kills 1,400 of its citizens and takes about over 200 hostages, most of whom have yet to be released. And if that weren't enough, we turn our eyes to the Pacific theater, and over there we have China threatening Taiwan almost every day. And anybody who dares enter the South China Sea might just get rammed by a Chinese Coast Guard boat. So much for world peace. Remember that illusion after World War II? We're going to make this United Nations. We'll discuss all of our problems. No more war. Perhaps you've all this that's happening has made you think or start thinking about end time events. And there's some reason for that. Jesus himself said in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 24 and verse number 4, that there would be wars and rumors of wars. I do like the word end in the end times because it does tell us something. There is an end to these times. Amen? There is an end in sight. And we know that because Jesus promised he'd come again. I like the promises of the Lord, and I love preaching on the promises. But just behind the promises that Jesus made to Christians are all the promises that God's made to Israel. They are his chosen people. And that's the subject of the message today. In fact, it's to them that many of the promises in the Bible have been written, and it's from whom the Bible and our Messiah has come. I'm troubled recently in the news, and I do scan the news from time. I don't live in the news. I do scan it from time to time. I don't know if you're troubled like I am by the anti-Semitic and Israel attacks that are going on social media and even major network headlines. Now, thankfully, I believe rightly, President Biden has come down on the right side of this in siding with Israel and being very upfront and open early on that we will support Israel. But despite his efforts, we have protests in New York City, in Central Station, in the train station, being locked down here a couple of days ago. Shut down, not locked down, because of protesters. And you've seen the protests on college campuses against the state of Israel, even accusing them of being the oppressor and the aggressor in this. What I'd like to do with the time remaining today is look at some reasons why we ought to support Israel, why Christians do support Israel, why I'm in favor of the United States supporting Israel. I've selected today Psalm 83 as our text today. Psalm 83, I'm going to read there just the first four verses. We will look at most of this psalm. Beginning in verse number 1, though, just verses 1 through 4, "Keep not thou silent, or silence, O God, hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people, and consulted against thy hidden ones. They have said, Come, and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance." These words seem apropos to the context right now in world affairs and what's going on with the most recent attack by Hamas. What I'd like you to do today is just consider with me some reasons, some things that will motivate your support for the state of Israel. Here we go. Number one, the first thing I want you to notice in our text is Israel and her enemies. Israel and her enemies. It's hard to find a time in Israel's history when she's not being threatened. A little bit toward the end of David's reign, there's a peace. And in Solomon's reign, for a while, there's peace. But most of the other time in the Old Testament, we're reading about Israel in conflict with her neighboring enemies. Remember, it's the Egyptians that enslaved Israel in Egypt. It's the Moabites who sought to curse Israel through Balaam the prophet. Remember that? And it's the Philistines who were constantly sending raiders up in border skirmishes with Israel throughout her history. The Assyrians surrounded her, and the Babylonians eventually carted her away. It's interesting to me that of all the peoples I just mentioned, only Egyptians still remain. All the rest of them are gone, and Israel still is. This really is a great mystery, isn't it? How come a tiny nation, which ranks something around 60th in size in the world, it's not a large nation at all. In fact, it's about the size of 88% of the state of Maryland. Maryland's bigger than Israel. It's a small country. Boasting about, right now, about 7 million Jews live inside the boundaries of Israel. Of course, there are Palestinians there, Arabs, etc. But in all these years, though it's so tiny and threatened by so many larger nations around it, somehow Israel's managed to survive. When you look at Israel's history, even the modern history from the founding of the state in 1948 till the present, the fact that Israel still exists is wow. You read some of these wars, the Six Days War, the initial conflict when Israel became a state, you're just like, how did they win? There's really mathematically no reason or why they should. And it leads many people to believe that you cannot explain Israel apart from supernatural intervention by a real God who is standing up for this little nation and this little group of people. I want you to consider from our text three characteristics of these enemies. Letter A, we want to go with the attack of these enemies. In verse number 2, we read, "For lo, thine enemies make a tumult." The word tumult means a great noise, usually produced by a crowd that's assembling, like as in battle. And this is not what happened. As one, the Hamas joined together on Sabbath while Israel's at rest and at play to attack the country when they least expect it, invading by land, air, and sea, killing civilians, and carting away hostages that we already mentioned. And there is no way, honestly, that anybody can justify this vigilante behavior. I don't care what side you're on. It's hard to stomach the fact that civilians were targeted with no warning. I want you to notice the second thing about her enemies, the agenda that's listed for us, and it's in the text. We find it in verses 3 and 4. They conspire together, taking crafty counsel. They consulted against thy hidden ones. Verse 4, they have said, "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may no more be in remembrance." That sounds strangely familiar to the present manifesto in charter number 11 of Hamas, which says something along the lines that if the manifesto advocates the destruction of the state of Israel and calls for the raising of the banner of Allah over every inch of Palestine. Which leads me to a quote. Have you heard this? Years ago when Benjamin Netanyahu, which incidentally is the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history to this point, he said, if the Arabs put down their weapons, there would be no more violence. If the Jews put down their weapons, there will be no more Israel. Some continue, however, to argue that if Israel would simply give Palestine her own state, then there would be peace in the Middle East. Two states, one Israel, one Palestine, peace. Truth is that if Israel, the truth is that Israel's offered the Palestinians a two-state system 5 different times. I was able to validate this various sources. I'm just going to read one of them. The Arabs have refused 5 official offers for a Palestinian state beside of Israel. Yet blame is heaped upon Israel as an obstacle to the state of Palestine. You probably remember, some of you do, Yasser Arafat and the prime minister at the time being brought to Camp David with Bill Clinton to work out some deal. And after everything that was conceded and offered both by President Clinton at the time and by, I think this is it Rabin? I might be getting the name wrong, of the prime minister at the time. Yasser Arafat refused every single offer to a two-state system. Hey, and if you wanted more details about this, I watched a neat video this week on YouTube. If this really fascinates you and you'd like to look at it some more, I'm going to include it in today's email with the sermon, and you can watch it and get the link from it in there. But very fascinating. It actually records the data of the five different times the two-state system has been offered, and Israel said yes, and it's the Palestinians who refused every single time. Why am I taking time to tell you this? Because you're not hearing this in the media at all. You're hearing about Israel being the oppressor, and you're hearing the headlines, mostly opinion headlines, of people who are against the state of Israel. And it's sad. It seems obvious then that the agenda of the Palestinians is not to have a state beside Israel, but is to have no state of Israel, period. And I hope you understand that really is their agenda. There's another thing that occurred to me about Israel and her enemies here, and it's the assembly. And we see this in the next few verses, verses 5 through 8. And the text is demonstrating how Israel's been surrounded by so many enemies, and they assemble together to attack her. Look at this, verse 5. Again, it mentions they consult together with one consent. They're confederate against thee. And then he begins to list them all. The Edomites and the Ishmaelites, the Moabites and the Hagarites, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, Tyre, and Asser. And so we're going to sort of talk about this. I did find a map of this, but it was just too small actually to show on the screen. But Edom is south to southeast of the Dead Sea. Ishmaelites, descendants of Isaac's brother Ishmael. Moab is toward east of the Dead Sea. Hagarites would be the descendants of Abraham's handmaiden wife, Hagar. So the Hagarites are her descendants, which would include Ishmaelites as well. Gebel, a little bit more difficulty on that one, but according to one source, this is southern Jordan near Edom. Ammon is east of the Jordan River. Amalek, they were the people that raided Israel while she was traveling through the wilderness in Upper Arabia. So again, south of Israel. Philistia, if you sweep around the southern portion of Israel and start up the coastal bank, you have Philistia that roughly corresponds to the Gaza Strip today. That area, not precisely, but Philistia had five big cities, Ekron, Ashkelon, Ashdod. Remember these cities in the Old Testament? They all belong to Philistia, and they all correspond roughly with Gaza. And then you have Tyre, which is up the western seaboard, north of Israel, corresponding roughly with Lebanon today. And Asher, of course, is Syria, ancient Syria. And all those nations are still in play, right? You've got Jordan on the east, and you've got Arabia in the south that still opposes Israel. Saudi Arabia has not joined the Abraham Accords. And then you've got the Gaza Strip and Lebanon and concerns about Hezbollah. What's the point? They're all assembled against her. They're all surrounding her from every side. She's got enemies, and that's still the case today. And so I just found this text to be unusually apropos, because this is exactly what's happening today. And there's concerns that other nations, as in the past 75 years of Israel's history, that other nations are to join in and be part of this. But despite the mountain of muscle aimed at the state of Israel, this psalm reminds us that Israel is because she has a great protector and a great safety. That's actually point number two, Israel and her safety. Verse 9 starts with an extended prayer, and it chronicles some of Israel's historical battles and victories. Let's read there, verse number 9. Do unto them, it's a prayer to God, do unto them as unto the Midianites, as to Sisera and to Jabin at the brook Kishon, which perished at Endor. They became as dung for the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb, yea, and all their princes as Zeba and as Zalmunna. So this has to do, Gideon and the 300 past victory. Most of us have heard about that, how God gave a great victory, though they were greatly outmanned by the Midianites. Later, under the Canaanite oppressors, God raised up Deborah and Barak to go into battle up in Megiddo near Mount Tabor. And remember, the commander of Jabin's army was Sisera, and he went to stop in a tent for a rest because he was worn out. And Jael took a nail and drove it through his temple, and Sisera was no more. So the psalmist is celebrating, hey, look, God gave us great victory with Gideon, with only 300. He gave us victory over the Canaanites because God sent rain to stick up their chariots so their wheels wouldn't go, and then drove the nail through Sisera. So he's celebrating. Look what God can do. God is a great protector for Israel, and he's done it, and he's pleading, God, do it again. You know, the Oreb and Zeb and Zalmunna, you know, all those names, they seem, but they were rulers or princes of the Midianites that Gideon dealt with, and he executed every one of them, and God gave great victory. So this is what the psalmist is doing. Lord, do that for us. And I've broken it down in his request in two ways. God, first of all, please, would you just deal with them? And this is a good thing to pray. We can pray for God to do right now for Israel. Look with me at verses 13 and following. We read, "Oh my God, make them like a wheel and as the stubble before the wind." Does that sound a little bit odd to you? God, the psalmist is praying, God, run over them like a wheel, which is how they, one of the ways they would crush the grain, getting the kernel away from the chaff, and then the wind, they would lift it up, and the wind would push the lightweight chaff away, and the grain would drop to the ground. That's how they harvested. So God, do that to our enemies. Just run over them with a wheel and blow them away like chaff. The next verse in verse 14 says, "Burn them down like a forest on fire. Burn them with wood as the flame set of the mountains on fire." And if that's not enough, verse 15, he gives another analogy. You know how the storm comes up and sweeps people away? Do that to our enemies. You've got to deal with them so that they're never again a threat. In fact, that's what comes in the next verses, 16 and 17. Fill their faces with shame. Let them be confounded and troubled so they're never a threat to Israel again. Can I put pause? There's a theological problem we have in this text. Okay, scratch your brain a little bit. They're known as imprecatory prayers or imprecatory psalms. Have you heard the term before? All right, so it means a prayer that's prayed against your enemies. God, let the enemies have it. And that almost sounds, doesn't that sound unchristian to you? You shouldn't do that. I mean, Jesus said, what did he say in Matthew chapter, was it 5, verse 44? Love your enemies. Do good to them that hate you. Pray for them that despise you. And there's one other thing that's not coming back to me. I ain't the same man I used to be. So why would it be right in the Old Testament to pray against your enemies? Jesus said in the New Testament, you're supposed to pray for your enemies. And sometimes this gets Christians a little bit, I don't know what to do with that. So let me give you a little bit of help. Number one, God reveals things to people over time, and Jesus had not yet come, and that revelation had not yet been given. So Israel did not yet have the New Testament. This actually happens in our culture today. We learn something like smoking is bad because the science teaches us that. So what do? We look at our ancestors and we go, oh, those stupid people smoked all those cigarettes and got cancer and died. How dumb of them, how smart we are. It's called intellectual or chronological, that's the word I'm looking for, chronological snobbery, that we're smarter than the people that used to be. That's really pride, right? So they didn't have all that we had. If Jesus had said those words, they would be more responsible for it, all right? So I think that's part of the argument. Anyway, let's not accuse them. Let's not be intellectual, chronological snobs about that. They didn't have the New Testament. Number two, the New Testament does teach us to turn our enemies over to the Lord. That is actually what the psalmist is doing. If you need the cross references, it's Romans chapter 12, verse 19 and following. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. The psalmist isn't saying, I'm going to lift up a sword and I'm going after those enemies and I'm going to kill those infidels. another religion does that, not the Christian religion. All right? But the New Testament teaches we turn as Christians our enemies over to the Lord. And you know, this applies way beyond Israel. Some of you have enemies. It could be your supervisor at work. It could be a family member that you're having to go see again over the holidays. It might be your neighbor next door who won't pick up the dog junk that's lying in your fence. And you understand, you have enemies, right? I must be the only one. And the Bible teaches us that we're supposed to turn our enemies over to the Lord. I'm not supposed to think, okay, he did that to me, so the next time I'm getting even. That's the carnal man. That's the ungodly man. As a Christian, I turn my enemy over to the Lord. And this is what the psalmist is doing. Lord, I remember what you did to the Midianites. I remember what you did to the Canaanites under Deborah and Barak. And you know what I want you to do? I want you to do that to our enemies today. And that's backing up and letting God be in charge. And that's okay to pray that way. And I think we do see that in the psalm. And I really think that's the biblical approach, whether we're dealing with Israel and our enemies or even your enemies. God, you blow them away. You do with them what you want in your time. But the psalmist isn't done. He just doesn't simply pray to let them have it or let God give it to them. He also, letter B, says, God, please teach them. I think this is a very insightful point in the message and in the psalm. In verse number 16, let's bring that up. It's, fill their faces, he prays, with shame. Yeah, we've talked about that. But for a purpose, that they may seek thy name, O Lord. He doesn't just want them to die and be gone. He wants them to understand who God is. Verse number 18 says it even more clearly. Last verse of the psalm, that they may know that thou, whose name alone is Jehovah, are the most high over all the earth. I want them to come in contact and understand who God really is. That's the deeper purpose. He wants them to acknowledge God as the Most High over all the earth. You know, as believers and supporters of Israel, I think sometimes we as Christians forget there's another side in the conflict. Rah, rah, we're for Israel. Get out our blue and white, wave our flags. But there are Arabs that are desperately in need of Jesus Christ. And they need the same forgiveness that you and I found. I'm not better because I live in America and they live in Palestine or in the Gaza Strip. I don't like to use the word Palestine. It is Israel. In fact, I was getting ready to preach today and I was just, Lord, is this really what you want me to share with people today? So I opened up my Bible for my devotions. I do that. You know, I read the Bible every day just for fun of it. Not for preaching, just for the fun of it. And I'm saying, Lord, it's got to guide my steps. So I end up in Psalm 114 today. Does anybody have that open? I don't have it open right now. 114, read the first verse. Somebody read it out. Who's got it? Sword drill, uh-oh. Go ahead. I read Psalms every day, but the Psalm today, the first verse, mentioned Israel. Like, okay. Then I read verse number 2. Go ahead. No, go ahead. Israel was his dominion. He's talking about the land of Canaan. I thought, all right, it's about Israel. I'm supposed to talk about their dominion in the land historically. That confirmed you're supposed to hear about Israel today. All right? I'm telling you, this is the way it works. You just walk with the Lord and he kind of just prompts you. Yeah, that's what I want you to do. Israel, it's Israel's dominion. It's her land. And the goal is not just rah-rah for Israel and her dominion of the land. The truth is, I'm supposed to be just as concerned for the other side and the souls of men and women who are dying without Christ and going to a hell that has no hope for them. I ought to be concerned about that. It ought to move me. You know, I want my neighbors to come to Christ. I pray for my neighbors all the time. I'm thinking about that and asking God for opportunities to speak to them about the Lord. And we ought to be praying for Israel's neighbors too. They need the Lord as well. Come to a knowledge of Him. Do you know that most Arabs grow up in schools where at least half the day they study Islam and the teachings of Muhammad? For half the day in their school system. How would you come out thinking if you heard 3 to 4 hours a day about Muhammad the prophet and about the Quran and memorizing it? Would you come out just to blindly do whatever they say? Probably. Probably. So how are we going to reach them? We need to pray for them that God would teach them that He is the real thing. I'm so thankful we don't hear about it because they're in closed country, but we've got missionaries and servants of the Lord all over the Middle East sharing the faith, trying to reach people for Jesus Christ. And if we don't pray for them, how else were they going to be introduced to God's love and mercy? A God who shows love and mercy, unlike the God they presently serve. Let me go a step further with this. Can I share something just interesting to me? You're not going to sleep yet, are you? Because I got something else to say. All right? Here's the next thing. Let's go back to verse number 1. In verse number 1, we read, let me have another slide here. Let's talk about God being silent. Verse number 1, we read, "Keep not thou silence, O God. Hold not thy peace. Be not still." Don't you see what the enemies are doing? God, don't go quiet on me. Help me out. You ever prayed that way? I need help, but it feels like a hard ceiling up there. I need help. Don't be silent. I want to tell you about another day when this is exactly what happened when somebody else was praying. Because there was a person called the Son of God, and His name is Jesus Christ, and He hung on a cross. And one of the things that He cried out from the cross is, my God, why have You forsaken Me? It did feel like a lid to him. God was silent, and because God didn't answer his prayer, because there was no answer, our sins were paid for, and Jesus Christ died in my place on that tree, and it's only because God remained silent that redemption was completed, and I stand here before you today as a redeemed child of God. Hallelujah. Sometimes it is better if God doesn't answer our prayers and remains silent. Let me finish by giving you a couple of responses that we ought to be making in light of what's going on presently and our response to Israel at all times. But first, I'd like to start with a caution. Mark Tooley was former member of the CIA, but now he's president of the Institute for Religion and Democracy. He made this insightful statement. We need to be very careful of acting like every single news flash connects to some obscure verse somewhere in the prophets. I'm talking to some of you out there. You've got Jeremiah and Ezekiel open. You're digging in Habakkuk and Haggai right now. You're turning the pages of Zechariah, and some of you don't even know what those are. They're all books of the Bible. And you're looking, is October 7th, 2023 somewhere in there? And what does this mean? And how many more days do we have it before the Antichrist rises up? Let me just caution you. Prophecy wasn't written for that purpose. It wasn't written for you to be able to make out a little timeline and put all your verses and all your thoughts into a nice sequential order so you know exactly what's coming. And I want to encourage you or caution you to be careful you don't get on YouTube or on the internet and start listening to some of these guys who can tell you exactly how many days we have now until the Lord returns. We don't know. And Jesus said we don't know. He said only my Father knows the day and the hour. You be very careful. What's the purpose of prophecy? This analogy is not original with me, but prophecy is like you standing on a mountaintop somewhere and you looking across several valleys to some other mountain peaks, and you can tell where the mountains are, but you can't tell me about all the topography or the rivers or the lakes that happen to be around those mountains. You can't see it. It's all kind of a little bit foggy. You know what the main things are, but you can't see every detail in the range. So God gives us enough to know the major features of prophecy, like the mountain peaks, but He leaves the details obscured. He does not give us so much that we can predict the future and start selling t-shirts. So prophecy contains a great deal of mystery, often only discernible after it happens. Case in point, Christmas, Isaiah 7:14, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a child." Boy, I'm really having trouble. Where's that? That's not coming to me. Isaiah 7:14, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel." There it is. So, Isaiah didn't get all that. What does that all mean? Didn't make sense till 700 years later when Mary, without being married, bears a son. And his name is called Emmanuel. So it's often after it that we go, "Oh, I see it now. God had it all planned out." That's it. That's the purpose of prophecy. It's to show you that God had the whole thing planned out from the beginning. Not so that you could start selling t-shirts or have a web channel, a YouTube channel where people follow you and pay you money. All right. Hope that's a help. Not that I'm a little passionate about that. Come to church, turn off the internet. All right. What should our response be to Israel? This is true whether they're at war or not. Here's the first one, an obvious one. Pray for peace. The psalmist said in Psalm 122, verse 6, "Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper that love thee." We ought to pray for God's people. Jesus said, right, salvation is of the Jews. John chapter 4, verse number 22. We have a Jewish Savior, and almost every Bible book, except Luke, Greek and a friend of a Jew, Paul, every Bible book that we know of has a Jewish author. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Our spiritual ancestry ties to the number two. We ought to be looking for the Lord. When you see things happening in the state of Israel, the reformation of the state in 1948, what's going on? We're getting close to the return of the Lord. And Jesus said, even in this Olivet Discourse, he said, when these things begin to come to pass, you start seeing things like this, look up, lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. It's getting close. We're a lot closer than we think to the return of the Lord. So is this present conflict going to be the flashpoint that erupts in Armageddon? Not if we understand as much as we do about prophecy, and we're right, and I'm not saying that we're right on everything. Prophecy is challenging. But as we understand it, there's going to be a rapture of the church first, 7 years of trouble called the tribulation. The book of Revelation explains that. And after that 7 years of tribulation on the earth, then there's a great battle called Armageddon. We're on the cusp. Things are happening. How soon we get to Armageddon remains to be seen. But we are seeing unprecedented developments in our day. Russia has come down out of the north. Some people believe that Russia corresponds to Gog and its leader Magog in Ezekiel chapter 38. And if that's so, and there's some reason historically to believe that, Russia's alliance with Persia, especially in the war in Ukraine, Iran has supplied drones to Russia to use on Ukraine. And in exchange, Russia's been sending missiles down to Iran. Where are they being used or stockpiled for? Yeah, so we are seeing developments that line up with some signals in the prophets, but we really don't know the time frame. Pastor Greg Laurie, I was reading this week, said, "Not once in the past 2,500 years has Russia formed a military alliance with Persia, that is present-day Iran, but they've recently developed a special connection. Russia has signed billions of dollars of deals to sell missiles to Iran, and the Iranians have helped the Russians, providing them with drones weaponized to use in the Ukraine war." Wow, we don't know all the details, but we know we're marching toward the triumph of Jesus Christ. Final point, what can we do? What should we do? Pray for peace, look for the Lord, and stand against anti-Semitism. You know, the trail of anti-Semitism is deeply entrenched and goes all the way back to the nation of Israel and a Pharaoh who said, I'm going to kill all the male boys born in Israel. I'm going to wipe them all out. Of course, two midwives, two dinky little midwives, they foiled all of his plans. And God got the glory, and God delivered Israel out of Egypt by Moses. But since then, nations like Assyria, Sennacherib came down like a wolf on his fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. All right, Lord Byron there. Sorry about that. But the Assyrians have tried to take Israel. Babylon tried to destroy Israel. Most recently, Germany in the 20th century tried to exterminate the Jews. This relentless pursuit has only one author, and his name is Satan. Revelation chapter 12 calls him the great dragon who stands over the woman about to devour her child. I think that's Revelation 12, verse number 4. It's very picturesque in light of the fact that Hamas, when they came across to do their you know, Hamas means violence. When they came across to do their violence, they targeted elderly, women, and children. That is satanic in nature. That is satanic. It's biblical to say that. Revelation 12, verse 4. The great dragon stood over the woman in order to devour her child. Woman and child mentioned there, and the great dragon. You see it? It's in the Bible. They think they're doing God a service, but they're blinded. They're not right. They're wrong. The Bible says in Genesis 12, verse 3, that God will bless them that bless thee, speaking of Abraham, and curse them that curseth thee. Did you know that since October 7th, we're just 3 weeks out, anti-Semitism has risen 300%. The incidence of anti-Semitism in our country have risen 300%. Wow. We're largely unaware of what's being done because it really doesn't make the news. It's not newsworthy. Here's a story from about 4 years ago, Melbourne, Australia. A 12-year-old Jewish boy was encircled by fellow students, not on the campus of the school, but after school, forced to kneel down and kiss the shoe of a Muslim boy while the other students looked on. And the incident was photographed and then posted to social media. That's how we know about it. Wow. You know, we may not be able to do all that we'd like for Israel, but one thing we can do is show our support for them. And one of the ways we do this is pray for their peace, look for the Lord's soon return, and stand up against anti-Semitism. I hope that you'll continue to support Israel and don't be duped by the media information.